Hello there. It is Saturday, July 19th. I'm here at the Coastside Farmers Market in Half Moon Bay and wanted to just share a little bit of what's going on here with folks today. It is peak summertime at the Coastside Farmers Market, so we have pretty much everything and anything you can imagine here on this beautiful, foggy Coastside day. And we've got strawberries, we've got flowers, we've got beans, blueberries, corn, beets, honey, and of course we have artichokes and Brussels sprouts. Those are a local specialty for anyone who knows that Coastside. Know that's part of our ingrained culture and agriculture here on the Coastside. It's just beautiful, tons of people. Parking lot's full, of course, so always encourage folks to come here by bike or by bus or walking. It's gorgeous, and it's near downtown, so you can get some other stuff done here as well. I'm here at last with Erin Torme, the director of the Coastside Farmers Market. Hi, Erin. I'm so excited to see you.
Hi, Sophia. I'm delighted to have you here.
Yeah. I love coming here to this ranch. You know I do.
Yes, I do.
My first time here, I don't know if you remember this, was probably about 10 years ago now.
Yeah, of course I do.
Yeah.
I came on a bird watching expedition.
Yes.
It was a fundraiser for the Heal Project.
It was.
Jim Howard. We all went bird watching and had lunch.
And we did. Great. And it was wonderful. Yeah. And my kids were a lot younger then, but they still remember it to this day.
Oh, nice.
So it's pretty cool. Yeah. I think it's in their, growing up on the Coastside, it's in their, and in their blood and in their bones and their teeth, probably.
I mean, that's great.
Yeah. To just be part of this, like, beautiful landscape that we have up here. And I have to say, you live in one of the most gorgeous places in the Bay Area, I would say. These beautiful hills. Irish Ridge is what this area is called, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So, tell me a little bit about, like, how did you get here? How did you land in this amazing place?
My mother used to say I had a knack for serendipity, and she was very right about that. I had a... You're right. This whole area is called Irish Ridge. And when I was born in this area, but left for quite some time. And during that time, had this amazing experience. I worked as a personal assistant for a man named Eric Johnson. He was one of the founders of Texas Instruments. But he had a little tiny bit of the Oppenheimer complex because of the work that he did. He lived in Texas, and he and a friend were out trying to create instruments that would find oil and water.
Oh, interesting.
In the weeds.
They were the ones that made the calculators too, right?
They were. Yeah. And when I met him, so the all these sonars and radars and things that they were developing ended up being during the Second World War used as instruments to find, like, submarines.
Oh, and that comes in handy during war.
Some things up. And he was an immigrant, came from Sweden. His father was a cobbler. But he had this very, when I first met him, he was nearly 80 years of age, and he had been retired from Texas Instruments for quite a long time and had dedicated the rest of his life to philanthropy. He was committed to getting a calculator on every desktop of every senior in every high school in the country. He wanted to get a computer on every campus and a calculator in every senior classroom.
That was pretty groundbreaking at that time.
It was very much. He was one of the early venture philanthropists.
Yeah.
But it was really interesting because he came from a completely different point of view around money, power, came from a completely different point of view around money and power than my background at all. And it was a pivotal relationship, really changed how I looked at the world and my place in it, you know. And so I'll be forever grateful to him. But it put me on a kind of an odd track because while everybody else was off going to college and like setting themselves up and making big life goals, I was working for this really interesting man And it just changed my life dramatically.
Yeah.
So when I came back to this area, I was almost, not quite 30, but going back to school mm-hmm. and, you know, finishing up some stuff and that kind of thing. And it's a long way around the barn, but I was came up the road one day to help a friend who was a filmmaker.
Yeah.
And had been... drive just came up this gorgeous place where I hadn't been since I was a really little kid.
Yeah.
And she wasn't home.
Yeah.
So I ended up walking back down the road.
Yeah.
Met this woman who was banging with a hammer on the side of a big wooden water tank. And I thought, well, there is a woman in trouble, because having grown up on, you know, funky ranches and properties out in the boonies and working for Mr. Johnson, I always drive around with a toolbox. When you live in Tahoe, it's one of those things you do.
You're ready to shovel the car out of the snow. Here, it's like fix the heat, the water tank.
And so I was like, I knew enough to know that you don't fix plumbing with a hammer. So I stopped, and she was very upset. We ended up having a kind of an interesting conversation. I helped her fix this thing. It was reverse thread coupling. You need two wrenches, one going in both directions.
Yeah.
Not intuitive at all. It's just one of those things. Like if you know what to do, then it looks really easy.
Yeah.
But if you don't, you'll be there all day being very frustrated.
Bending your brain backwards and forwards.
Exactly.
Literally.
Losing your ever loving mind. But anyway, I just stopped and helped her. And then, you know, just as we were getting finished, my friend, her name is Susan, came up the road.
The filmmaker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And anyway, we ended up, Jackie basically called me the next day. She'd got my number from Susan and called me up within a couple of days. And, she'd been speaking to Jesus, and he said I was supposed to live here.
Yeah.
And we had a very odd conversation after
that.
Yeah,
yeah.
But, you know, I think Jesus is great. I'm not so fond of some of his editors. But,
yeah.
You know, I don't typically have direct conversations with him.
I love that.
He's a great storyteller.
Yeah.
But anyway, it just was a very just unusual set of circumstances. But when I did get here, she and her husband had bought it as a second home and just a kind of a weekend getaway. But he died fairly soon thereafter. They hadn't even known it for a year. And so when I got here, like, they bought it and no one had lived here for quite some time.
Yeah.
They were just getting kind of started on rehabilitating the property when he passed away. She had no earthly idea what to do about any of it.
All the vision,
but
not
all the tools. So no, when I got here, there was weeds to the walls. I walked in and out of this house for the first 3 years on basically crates and planks.
Yeah.
Before I, you know, there wasn't a single cultivated plant. There wasn't a fence that functioned. Nada.
Yeah.
And the house was mostly finished inside, but the roof blew off the first winter I was here.
That's how it goes.
Re-engineer the foundations.
So country leaving.
Slide down the hill. that wood water tank, as you've noticed, is no longer here.
And
ended up putting in a rain catchment system that I found out later was illegal, but it's fine now.
You know.
All kinds of, you know, it just was one of those things. And I, you know, living kind of off the beaten path has always been sort of central to my being.
Yeah.
But so it was very, you know, very challenging. But, you know, getting a farm started from scratch had not been in my life plan necessarily, but neither had like finding myself on a 70-acre property out in the middle of nowhere.
Right, right.
Or it's certainly not nowhere, but
when
you're each neighbor is more than a mile away, it's sort of, you know.
It feels oddly like nowhere. And I think that's like the special thing, the amazing thing about it is it's not nowhere. There's San Francisco, 40-45 minute drive from here. San Jose on the other side, probably about an hour or so.
Basically, you know, an hour from this house to anywhere you want to
be. It's not in the middle of anywhere, but it's so peaceful and tranquil up here. I mean, we hear the chickens in the back, which is the part of the farm, which is fantastic. You have the dogs. We're here and we see a lot of like birds flying around. I noticed when I was driving up some quail, and I love the sound that the little quail make. You always know it's like the quail. I hear the ducks. Maybe we could walk over here and hear the ducks quacking.
Yeah.
We heard your dog. So it's like this beautiful...
My guard ducks.
The guard ducks and the pet dogs. Guard ducks, pet dogs.
The dogs are working dogs.
No, yeah.
So what we've got going on here now is this, you know, is this what most people would call an integrated regenerative farm. So it's an integrated system where we have these ducks. There's two different varieties back here. They're all terrestrial layer ducks, which provide really amazing, humongous eggs that are incredibly rich that I love for baking. They work really well for some folks who can't tolerate chicken eggs for one reason or another. It's sort of like the goat milk, cow milk, sheep milk situation.
Proteins, yeah.
Same proteins, different combinations and ratios. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the ducks all kind of hang out there. It's really interesting. Like, if you bake at all, there's nothing like a duck egg for baking.
I've never done that. But I'm going to have to try it.
Yeah, do it.
I like baking. Oh, I like eating baked foods.
Probably especially just why I like baking.
Yeah. Well, we live in a climate that's pretty moist most of the time.
Yeah.
A lot of humidity in the air. And that can make certain kinds of baking a little bit challenging, especially like meringues and stuff like that.
Oh, that's why it doesn't work, because I've tried meringues.
Whites of duck eggs are so muscular, that particular protein combination. Like, you think about what has to come out of a chicken.
Yeah.
And I didn't, sorry, if you think about...
Yeah, I have four chickens at home, too. And I've seen what comes out of a chicken. It's interesting. So fascinating.
What I meant to say is that for us, eggs are food, but for these creatures, they are the next generation, right? So there's this really interesting and amazing science that goes along with all of it, right?
Yeah.
So you have an egg that's going to produce a chicken, and that chicken chick is going to come out with very fine little feathers, tiny little feet, tiny little beak. Mm-hmm. You think about a duckling, though. They come out with this huge, big beak, very heavy-boned legs, and these giant webbed feet.
Interesting.
So the product of that egg is a very different creature.
Yeah.
And so the nutritional needs to make sure that creature emerges healthy, built right, so that they can float but get around and not sink. But like, chicken feathers are completely different than a duck feather. You get a chicken feather wet and that chicken is a goner.
I've had that happen. It's very sad. It's very sad. So I'd never thought of chickens drowning, but it makes sense because they didn't evolved to float as opposed to ducks evolved to float. And it makes sense then that, like, if you go back a step in their biological processes and the development, and that's what I studied. I don't know if you know that about me.
Nope.
I studied biology in undergrad and went more to molecular biology by the time I got to graduate school. But it's I love that about science and integrating with nature and really integrating with agriculture too, where you understand things full circle. Like, why is a duck egg work better for meringues? Well, actually, it's because ducks have bills. Like, what?
It is. Those proteins, just when you denature them and whip them up like that, they hold their loft, they hold their shape. They're unbelievable if you're cooking with or baking with gluten-free in mind, or with nut flours or things like that tend to be real oily, because most of the flour substitutes are really heavy.
Yes.
And they're not going to develop any of their own, you know, strands of protein that connect one ingredient to the next. And, but if you look at the older cookbooks, and in the entire canon of European bakery, you often find now, as the more modern cookbooks will ask you for two eggs and a yolk. And that is because back in the day, in our grandparents, great grandparents' ages, ducks were always in people's gardens. You can keep a couple of ducks in your garden.
Yeah,
they'll lay eggs very consistently.
Yeah.
But they are not going to rip your garden to shreds
like a chicken would.
They do adore and love to just mow down on snails and slugs.
Oh, which is great.
More surface kind of things, critters.
Yeah.
Rather than there's different breeds and varieties of duck. Mm-hmm. Most people think of duck eggs and they think of them having a sort of an off or a gamey or a little bit of an umami kind of tinge to them. And that it would be true out of ducks that were more aquatic. These are not. These are European variety ducks that
terrestrial.
Are not aquatic.
Yeah.
So the ones that spend most of their life in the water
and
they eat aquatic plants and aquatic bugs and aquatic snails are going to have a different flavor profile.
Oh, so interesting.
So where most of the ducks who come from Indonesia, Micronesia, Asia,
yeah,
tend to be used in integrated pest management systems, yeah, in a different way.
Yeah.
In at this ranch and in most like European settings,
yeah,
the ducks would be what you had in your garden and the chickens would be what you left out in your field, because yeah, it's helpful to have, yes, your fields ripped to smithereens at the, yeah, end of the year,
yes,
to eat weed seeds and
kinda
everything
like
else and to poop everywhere, yeah, and to do that sort, yeah, of thing and to rake it back into the soil.
Yeah.
And they're, yeah, so, but here, so the ducks, we just, they traverse from this paddock over here, which is about a quarter of an acre where they spend most of their time. It's very easy to guide them over there into my little personal garden,
yeah,
which is very, not looking great this year, but guide them into my personal garden where they just like eat all the snails and slugs along the ways, and they're kind of fine. And the dogs are trained, they're McNab collies, so they're trained,
oh, yeah,
to keep,
yeah,
the... this little herd share that I've got going, oh, with the Avalos.
I remember these last time, and I was here too.
Yeah.
I think the calf had just been born last time I was,
yeah,
there.
Well, she's looking big.
Is that her down on the bottom? Like
that's
on the left?
Her, oh, it's not the white one?
Oh, it's the white one.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the calf.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I didn't remember what color.
Yeah.
But she's gotten so big, she,
yep,
almost blends in with the,
yeah,
the big ones.
Well, she's 6 months old now.
Yeah.
So it's
just getting big.
It's a thing. But
that's
like
so
you,
cool,
when you were here, like you got the end product of it all, right?
Yeah.
So these ducks, they
that
do their march
compost
out, eat all their stuff.
Yeah.
They chow things down in the garden. All the weeds end up in the compost pile, along with piles of, you know, chicken duck house bedding and that sort,
yeah,
of thing. And you,
yeah,
end up with this
anything
amazing
organic
compost. And
yeah,
that's kind of...
It's been great for my plants, by the way.
Oh,
I have
good
to thank you for that. I was so grateful. It's like fresh, well, cured,
yeah,
but like homemade compost, which, yeah, is beautiful and, yeah, rich and is like growing. Like, oh my gosh, my artichoke was crazy this year. I think,
nice,
it, like the artichoke especially appreciated it.
Yeah. No, it's a, yeah, helpful thing because not everybody has enough. I mean, you have to have quite a lot of space to raise chickens or ducks or anything for an egg crop.
Yeah.
I'm kind of giggling lately at everyone running out in order to combat the price of eggs by going and buying a bunch of chickens,
oh, yeah,
to raise and spending thousands of dollars on these gulags that you have. Because they taste,
yeah,
like chicken. Everybody,
yeah,
wants to eat them.
Yeah.
So the bobcats, your neighbor's cats,
yes,
are actually in an urban environment. It's they're much more endangered because,
yeah,
there's not as much to chow down on. Like,
yeah,
out here, like you talked about the quails you saw on the side,
yeah,
of the road. Those are what are more attractive to,
yeah,
the bobcats,
yes,
and the whatnot than coming around here and having to,
yeah,
deal with my dogs or,
yeah,
deal with me or deal with a pellet gun.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, yeah, you know? So it's just kind of one of those
easy
things
prey.
Where you just like, you know,
they,
we move these ducks every couple of years. I'll just change that paddock size.
Yeah.
So, or change the location of it. And the same with the chicken yard, put different gates and they go,
yeah,
out into different fields at different times of the day and different times of the year.
Yeah.
So like out, now that we're past the green part of the season, chickens' nutritional needs start changing and it's we roll into the seed season and they,
yeah,
start molting and they start, you know, getting their bodies ready,
yeah,
for winter time. I think that's something else that people have no idea,
yes,
about until they think,
yeah,
it through.
yeah,
that chickens stop laying.
Yeah.
In,
yeah,
the fall.
Yeah.
And they let their bodies rest and get nourished so that they can have, they're not going to, again, like eggs are food for us, but they are future generations for these animals.
Yeah.
And if, when they're not raised in, when they're not the breeds that have been specifically, basically engineered,
mm-hmm,
that's not the right word.
Yeah.
When they're not the breeds that have been selected over
selected,
time,
yeah,
to just fire off a whole bunch of eggs,
yeah,
precociously and prodigiously,
yeah,
you know, those chickens that are in, like, any egg you're going to get in a grocery store is,
yeah,
coming from a confined animal,
yeah,
whether or not they call it free range or not. Free range does not mean that they're outside, like, home on the range like,
yeah,
this. That just means that they're not caged for their lives.
Okay.
They're in big old confined houses. They typically do not go outside.
Yeah.
They might have what they call access to the outside, in which case most of the time it's a little hole in the door that goes out to a little tiny strip, not any wider than this.
Yeah.
That's usually destroyed within a week or two, and usually only,
yeah,
by the chickens, and thinking like there's tens of thousands of these birds in each one of these houses,
yeah,
at any given time.
Yeah.
And only the ones that ever got to that end that were curious to go out there
got
go
outdoors
out there. But
yeah.
So those they're most of the backyard chickens that people think of when they,
yeah,
think of a
free range
chicken,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
farm is really,
yeah,
not what,
yeah,
you're doing.
It's really,
and
free range in that they're not individually confined. They're free within a fairly cramped quarters with a bunch of other chickens.
They're still in a confined situation. It's really, that's the economics of it. And that's part of the, and it is not part of, it is why the avian flu threat and the impacts of it have been so devastating.
Yeah.
But I also believe that it's, basically you have that many people, critters confined in one space. Anybody gets a little bit sick and you're all going to go.
It spreads.
And so they've had to depopulate, they call it, which is basically just killing off millions of chickens in this country.
Yeah.
Because so many of them are raised that way. But I think what it's brought to the surface and for people's consciousness is that these are animals. And that you can't just like put a bunch more chicks in somewhere and expect that your egg prices are going to go drop down to well below what they're worth.
Yeah.
Like that, I think that people are going to continue to be a little bit surprised by it, but hopefully they'll recognize that it's the value. I mean, eggs have always been a very deeply, in this country and only in this country, are they as deeply undervalued as a really beneficial protein source. We expect eggs to be
elsewhere.
Like so cheap that you have four egg omelets that nobody needs. That you have, like, you just throw them around. Throw them at people's houses. And
it's like beans.
And
right?
So
it's
now
beans are cheap protein.
Well, but it's it's a different kind of a situation. Beans are also something that you can keep dry for many, many years.
Exactly.
And they'll
they're
be
totally
just fine.
Different.
And it doesn't change what their nutritional delivery is. And it's not the same with an egg.
But
It's and also, it's the way you treat your critters that are doing that for you. So
it's super important.
Anyway, long and short of it is that I think that I'm hopeful at any rate that this experience that most people have been having, it's not a stretch to say, like we talked about this before, it's not a stretch to say that this most recent election turned on the cost of food and the price of eggs.
Yes.
And everybody's always talking about bringing the price of eggs back down.
Yeah.
And my great hope for humanity is that that never happens.
Yeah.
Because they are an extremely valuable source of protein.
Yeah.
They are an extremely, there is not a food culture anywhere in the world. They are globally recognized as being an incredibly valuable food source.
Yes.
And only in this country do we treat them like little machines that are not worth anything.
Yep.
And we treat that product, like I said, as trash, as something to throw on people's houses you don't like. And it's just
terrible. I always hated that, only for the mess it made, but like, that's just wrong. I remember now as you're talking, I remember a children's book, and I'll have to find it for you. It was about a superhero, and the superhero was powered by what they called like protein. I forget exactly what they called it, but it was something like protein, super protein orbs. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like a euphemism for they were eggs.
Mm-hmm.
It was powered by eggs. Yeah. And that's what like made him a superhero. Oh, yeah. Like I'll have to find that book and show it to you. Because it was fundamental about eggs and how like, you get so much benefit in nutrition. And what I love about it too, and your approach to this and like through the integrated agriculture concept of having, the dogs and the ducks and the fields and the movement and the hens and,
Well, it's also the orchard too. I mean,
and the orchard all together.
Like, yeah, it's lovely.
All works together.
It all is of a piece, and I'm incredibly fortunate because I think a lot of people, when they think about a farm, they think about something that looks a little bit more like this.
Yeah.
And it's only the grace of God and Roger's money that, can do something like this.
It's really hard.
It's a huge amount of work. But I am in a highly improbable situation that I'm able to do all this.
Yeah.
Right. So there's like 70 apple trees and pear trees and plum trees on this property, and they're all in kind of different sort of places, and they all benefit from the compost and from the critters getting in there and eating all that. Like I let the chickens in at certain times a year into the orchard, but you can't leave them in there the whole entire time.
Yeah.
Because you do need to have some green on the ground.
Bit. Yeah.
And you have like the cows. I have the cattle that are down here in this lower bowl in a part of the property that by most definitions is not particularly productive.
Mm-hmm.
I just work this herd share with the with Rocio Avila.
Oh, yeah, and, Rocio.
Yeah, and her family and her husband's brother. So there's four of us, and we each all have a... Seraphine has one,
wow,
I have one.
That's so cool.
Rocio has one.
And they have the beans. They're the bean protein.
They have the bean protein. But so we've been doing this for a bunch of years. And so it's kind of great because the cows will come up and they'll chew down all of this up here. And then we'll let the chickens out there to dig through the cow poop, get all the flies out of there, and just spread it around. And then they kind of move all over the place, and the ducks move and they follow. Everybody kind of follows each other around the spot.
Yeah.
You have to kind of be mindful about that. And doggies have figured out that they're supposed to chase off ravens, but leave the rest of the birds alone.
Oh,
and
good,
they're supposed
good.
To run.
They're smart. McNabs are known for their intelligence, right?
Their hogs off. So it's all, you know, it's just like all of a piece, but it doesn't happen overnight.
No.
Right. No. And it's one of those things that's taken me 20, 30 years or however long it is to get it where it's at now. And I just wait. One of the things I always appreciate when somebody comes up here and looks around and goes, oh my, look how beautiful. Because most of the time I'm looking around going, oh my
God.
That gate is falling off again.
It's all about where we live. It's like, yeah, you see the things for improvement, which is how you get the improvement. But it's like you come out with fresh eyes and you see all these beautiful pieces working together.
Stay tuned for the second part of our conversation in an upcoming episode where we talk about where all the flowers went and about Aldo Giusti, Del Cabo tomatoes, and more, coming soon. On Location, Coastside Edition with Sophia Lane is produced by Bright Now Media. Thanks for listening.